in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2004 lecture series presents This Woman Has Been Sentenced to Death by Stoning, media coverage of Zina cases in Nigeria by Aisha Imam, founding director, Baobab, for Women's Human Rights in Nigeria, distinguished recipient 2002 John Humphrey Freedom Award, on Thursday, April 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this first part of the program, we'll be talking about the state of nutrition in the developing world, looking at some of the problems and some of the trends, and perhaps asking the question, what sort of interventions are going on and are possible? And our guest for the program in this first hour is Reynaldo Martorell. He's professor of international nutrition. He's also chair of the Department of International Health of the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University, and that's in Atlanta. His principal research looks at both the short and long-term consequences of nutritional deficiencies during pregnancy and also in the first 2 years of life, and has done a lot of research in Latin America, in Mexico, and in Guatemala. And we have ample evidence to show, and certainly his research does show, that quality of the kind of nutrition that moms get when they're pregnant and also that children get in their first couple of years, that's very important to both their physical development and also their mental development, and that the quality of nutrition can make a big difference. Also, I think he's found, and other people have found, that the intervention certainly is possible. And if things weren't what you'd think would be ideal in the first couple of years, it is still possible to do something about that, and it can make a difference in people's later life. He's here visiting the campus, going to talk on this very subject as part of the ACES Global Connect seminar series. He'll be talking this afternoon on the campus, and I'm glad that he's here with us. Of course, people who are listening, if you have questions, comments, you can pick up the telephone and call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How exactly do we define, say, if we use a term, and I suppose it's maybe not a scientific term, like malnutrition, how exactly does one define that? It strikes me that there could be a fair range if we're talking about the difference between ideal nutrition and less. There could be a fair range there.
Yeah. I'd like to think of malnutrition as an iceberg. An iceberg has a visible portion on top if you're sitting on a boat. And that's clinical malnutrition. That's the kind of malnutrition that has dramatic signs. For example, if it's severe vitamin A deficiency, the eye will be impacted. If it's severe protein energy malnutrition, the child will be thin and wasted. So that's visible, but that's the small portion of it. The biggest portion of the iceberg is invisible underneath the water. And so, and that's the biggest concern in public health. And that we measure by looking at taking blood samples, for example, and measuring vitamin A levels in blood, or measuring often, the most common indicator is child growth failure. So by knowing the child's weight and height and age and comparing that to a reference population, we could make a diagnosis of malnutrition, which is not based on clinical signs. Mm-hmm. So most of malnutrition is invisible, actually, mm-hmm. but quite important.
How many people are we talking about, or how many children are we talking about, particularly in this category where you might have children who's to the layperson or the casual observer, it might not be obvious, but there are measurable indicators. Things that if you went in and did a study and did the kind of things that you did and others have done, you could definitely identify a group of people. I mean, how many children are we talking about?
In terms of the problem of child malnutrition measure in terms of growth failure, we're talking about 125 million in the developing world. Hmm. and which is a figure that has come down from about 160 in 1990. So we have some progress, but they're good news and bad news, good and bad news depending upon what part of the world. China, for example, has seen its rates of child malnutrition decline very rapidly. Other countries like Thailand, even India has had some success. Slow, but the rates are coming down. The biggest problem we have is in sub-Saharan Africa, where rather than the problem improving, it's actually going the other way. We're very, very concerned. It's the only region of the world. There's some countries that within sub-Saharan Africa that are doing a little bit better, but as a whole, the region is a major concern.
Can you talk about what this means for children's development in ways that are other than physical? I mean, you talked about you could see markers of physical growth. Yeah. That would be one thing. But it also does have – it impacts ability to learn. And it does all sorts of other things that aren't – that you can't see when you look at the child's body.
Maybe we'll come back to the physical part because I also think it's important. But, yes, the period of pregnancy in the first 2 years of life, it's really a critical phase of human development when a lot of brain development takes place during that time. A lot of learning takes place, interaction between mother and child. And malnutrition impacts at a very fundamental level. And we now have long-term studies that show that the quality of growth and development of nutrition in that early period impacts on how far children are going to go in school, more importantly, how much they're going to learn from the schooling that they get. So what I would tell to a minister of education in a developing country is that, yes, we need to offer children the opportunity to go to school. We have to improve the quality of the schools, the quality of the teachers, and so on. But in addition, we also have to make sure that children have a good early start in life because that's going to improve how much they learn. Mm.
I didn't mean to slight the issue of physical development or impact on physical development. And there are some other things that you'd like to say about that.
Yeah. I think it's all very important. For example, this early period of pregnancy in the first 2 years, when you go to a developing country, let me start that way, and you characteristically you see that the populations are very, very short. That shortness actually comes from malnutrition in early childhood and in pregnancy. And so having a small body size, a small muscle mass, presents a number of problems. For example, for women, it presents problems in delivery, so it's a cause of maternal mortality. For men, it impacts work capacity and how much, in physically demanding jobs such as cutting sugar cane, for example, muscle mass would be an important determinant of earnings. So there are a number of important aspects. And one that's fundamental to begin with is survival. Malnutrition really kills by increasing what's called the case fatality rate. In other words, children who are malnourished are not likely to survive many common infections, diarrheal diseases, pneumonias. So it kills by making the child more susceptible to these infections. And about half of child mortality in developing countries is associated with the kinds of malnutrition that we just described, which you can only measure by rates of growth failure. So it's from survival to a lot of other things. It's quite important. We have a project in Guatemala where we're following a population that we began studying in the 60s and 70s. That population is now 26 to 40 years of age. And what we're looking at is the importance of childhood nutrition for intellectual functioning, schooling, the kinds of physical aspects that I was talking about, but also occupation and economic productivity, because we think that ultimately it's linked to occupation and earnings, and therefore, it ought to be seen, investments in this early childhood period, as a long-term economic investment. That's a message we're trying to get to ministers of finance and so on.
Mm. And as I said at the beginning, you're particularly interested in the period of pregnancy and then the first 2 years of life. So I'm sure from that we conclude that that's in a very important window, that if you can intervene there, you're going to make a difference later. Are the kinds of things that we're talking about, if you cannot intervene early, but you can intervene yet in the child, in the childhood period, can some of the things that we're talking about, can that be changed, or is there some critical period where you say if an individual does not get adequate nutrition there, there's going to be a lifelong effect, and it while you can make some difference later, you can't completely turn things around.
It's a bit like you put it. I mean, you could actually improve conditions quite a bit. By improving conditions, you could improve, for example, cognitive development markedly, but there would always be a residual effect. The best data actually come from adoption studies. There are some well-known studies that were done by Professor Winnick that were published in Science some years ago. They were studies of children adopted from orphanages in Korea right after the Korean War. And these children were brought to the United States. And as a group, they for example, had IQs at school age that were, in fact, a little bit higher than the U.S. norm or than the U.S. performance. However, you could see a relationship between the state of nutrition in early childhood and in IQ. So a residual effect, but I think the best message is that you could recuperate a lot. Children are very malleable.
I should here introduce again our guest, if you've just tuned in. We're talking with Dr. Reynaldo Martorell. He's professor of international nutrition at Emory University. He also heads up the department there, chair of the Department of International Health at the Rollins School of Public Health, and is particularly interested in his research in the subject that we're talking about here, what it means over the long term for children if they have inadequate nutrition in their first couple of years of their life. Questions are welcome. I guess maybe I should apologize. I had somebody who was hanging on and maybe made them wait too long. If they would like to call back, we'd be happy to take their call. And, of course, anyone who's interested in joining in here asking questions is welcome to do that. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I guess it's also my understanding that here the kind of effect that we're talking about, would you could see that anywhere you had in any society, if you had those kinds of nutritional deficiencies, you're going to see those kinds of effects. But I guess it's also my understanding that poverty will magnify those effects. So that's another variable that you have to take into consideration.
Poverty is the root cause of problems of nutrition, but the poverty, for example, at the level of the family, ultimately results in poor availability to food, problems of poor child care, and poor access to health services, and to poor environmental sanitation. So ultimately, through those mechanisms, poverty results in diets that are deficient and in infections. So infections are just as important in terms of causing malnutrition. So the solutions, have to do with controlling in childhood infections and improving the diet. And, of course, a key start in life has to be breastfeeding. Exclusive breastfeeding for 4 to 6 months. We know that in developing countries particularly, that is so important for child survival and for child nutrition. And then improving the diet of the child in the first 2 years, as a, you know, complementary feeding of children. Mm-hmm.
And of course, there you have to consider or take into account the health of mom, whether or not she's going to be able to produce adequate nutrition. Not only are we thinking about her nutritional needs, but then she's providing the nutritional needs of somebody else.
It turns out that in terms of milk production, that it's not greatly affected, which means that, of course, you know, that it's an enormous, it comes at a cost to the mother. But you're right, you know, the health and nutrition of mothers is actually essential. So a lot of programs programs typically that look at improving childhood nutrition have also to consider improving the nutrition of the mother. For example, anemia is extremely common in women in developing countries. In India, for example, as a national average, about 80% of pregnant women are anemic, which is a huge problem, and that's related to the risk of death during delivery, not because an anemic mother is going to bleed more, but rather that an anemic mother is not going to tolerate much bleeding. And also it's related, it's an important cause of low birth weight.
Well, there that suggests, I was going to go on and perhaps ask a question about whether there are particular nutrients that are a particular concern. Now here, obviously, we're talking about iron deficiency in this particular case. Are there some very specific things?
Yes. In the developing world where most diets are plant-based, there are problems with two minerals. One is iron that we were just talking about. It's the most common deficiency in the world. It even affects people in this country. Iron deficiency affects something like 4 to 5 billion people. The other, in zinc, it's also a mineral about which we now know quite a bit about it, its effects. It's, for example, we have studies that show that in these populations that are zinc deficient, that if you supplement children with zinc, you know, these are scientific studies, you reduce the incidence of diarrheal diseases by about 25%, which is equivalent to the introduction of water, and reduce the incidence of pneumonia by 40%, which is equivalent to the best vaccines we have available. So zinc is very critical. And how do we get zinc and iron into the diets? Well, one is through fortification of flour, and the problem with that intervention is that it will impact only urban populations, or urban populations are more likely to benefit, and people in the rural areas may not. Another nutrient is iodine. We have a very good intervention. We could put it into salt. And a lot of salt is being iodized in the world. Another key nutritional deficiency is vitamin A deficiency, which is, in its severe form, leads to blindness. But in the mild and moderate states, increase mortality. And so we have, again, a very good evidence that a single dose of a mega dose of vitamin A, a pill, small pill, given every 4 months, can reduce child mortality by 23%. That was the average of a thorough analysis of this research that's been done. So UNICEF and a number of other organizations are really interested in bringing these interventions, iodized salt, vitamin A supplementation, pushing fortification of flours, nutrition education, promotion of breastfeeding. Those are some of the interventions that we could do. And we know that they work. We just need to design good programs to manage them well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know certainly if you ask a nutritionist about supplementation, they'll tell you what their idea would be, for people to get all of these things in their diet and not take a pill. But if that's what you got to do, that's what you got to do. I would guess that also that the kinds of interventions that you were talking about, I could be wrong, but it doesn't sound to me like we would be talking about an enormous amount of money either.
Well, Just the comment you made about supplementation. Yes, I mean, I think ultimately the most sustainable solution is to improve diets in general. But we're talking about very poor people, and we don't want to wait for economic development to take place, especially when we have such effective interventions as vitamin A supplementation. And in terms of how costly those kinds of interventions are, I mean, to us in the United States, they may not seem very expensive, but we're talking about very poor societies, but it's a choice that they have to make. And we believe that it should be a priority, and that even very, very poor countries, Bangladesh, for example, can allocate resources to these critical needs.
Mm-hmm. Well, how much money would we be talking about if we set aside for a moment who is going to pay for it? Take a particular country, and say, since you raised Bangladesh, supposing that you decided, well, this you wanted to do this, we were going to set up an agency, and we were going to do that, and we were going to foot the bill. How much money would we be talking about?
Well, you put me on the spot. You know, it's going to be a guess, but the exact amount may not be precise, but the order of magnitude might be. We may be talking about $40 per child per year, for example, something like that, which is significant. But on the other hand, from what we know, we would argue that the returns to the country are going to be great, and that because it's going to impact on the future productivity of that population.
Hmm. What sort of interventions are going on now? I mean, can you point to a particular place as a case study and say, and sort of talk about what's happened there and then what the result has been?
Thailand is a good example of a country where now for many years there have been very good community health and nutrition interventions. Typically, the best programs have well-trained personnel that often, you know, from the same community, so and also elicit community participation. They promote, for example, the monitoring of child growth and nutrition education to mothers, promotion of breastfeeding, but also integrated within the provision of healthcare, prenatal services for mothers, vaccinations for children, programs of environmental sanitation. So it's integrated health and nutrition. And also family planning, because you want to space children adequately, ideally 2 to 3 years would be best. And, of course, you would want to reduce the fertility rate in countries like sub-Saharan Africa to give mothers a chance to raise their children well.
Yeah. So it really is it's a complicated picture, at least in the sense there are a number. If you talk about intervention, it's not just sort of one thing. It's a number of things. It encompasses general kinds of education. It encompasses some education maybe about nutrition, maybe providing some supplementation.
Exactly.
Also talking about family planning and also providing means to do that. So
environmental sanitation, controlling, for example, building latrines, safe water, because as I said earlier, infections, particularly diarrheal diseases, are a major, major cause of malnutrition. So it's all of that. So it's integrated health and nutrition programs.
And it strikes me that this we're also not talking about something that's particularly high tech.
No.
These kinds of basic interventions, is that not the kind of thing that non-governmental organizations have been trying to do for decades?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And so it's not high tech. It's applying knowledge that we have. And the difficulty is that, we have to pay very close attention to how we design these integrated programs. And we have to monitor them to make sure that they're working efficiently, and when they're not, we have to to do operations research, to find out where the bottlenecks are and come up with solutions. So none of it is high-tech. It just takes a lot of work. And they're very good organizations, as you were saying, non-governmental organizations that are quite knowledgeable about this, and we work with them in our School of Public Health.
Mm-hmm. We are just about at our midpoint here, and I guess I'd like to introduce again a guest for this hour of focus. Rinalda Montrell is professor of international nutrition at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be talking about this very subject, about nutrition in the developing world, as part of the ACES Global Connect seminar series this afternoon at 2 on the U of I campus. And I'm assuming that anybody who's interested in turning out for the talk should certainly feel welcome. And, of course, people here, if you have questions you'd like to call in on this program, that's welcome too. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. Well, we do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Just a moment ago, you talked about the fact that there certainly are non-governmental organizations that have been doing this kind of work that know pretty well how to do it and have done it successfully. What sort of governmental support is there, though, for this most basic kind of developmental work?
What's happening in developing countries is that many governments now are working through these NGOs, non-governmental organizations. So more and more of the delivery of these programs is being done with governments working in conjunction with some of these NGOs. Some of the new funding coming from, for example, from the World Bank is being channeled through these organizations. You still need the government to set standards, to coordinate, but they need help in this new modality of working in corporate system.
I wonder if we could shift just a little bit and talk about something different. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I'm sure for a lot of people will be counterintuitive, and that is that one is starting to see in developing countries an issue that we certainly see here in the United States, and I'm sure we see in Europe and other places, and that is people who are over their ideal weight. We're here starting to see a real serious problem with obesity in the United States and the kind of chronic conditions that accompany that. Mm-hmm. Things like diabetes, for example, and heart disease. We have seen significant numbers in the increases in numbers of children and adolescents with type 2 diabetes, which generally in the past has been something that we have seen. If it's going to develop, it's going to develop when in adulthood. That's what we used to call it, adult onset, and they don't call it that anymore. But a surprising and disturbing trend that a lot of people have seen, that we see adolescents who have that. Well, apparently also in the developing world, we're starting to see the same thing.
Very much so. And we at Emory University have become very interested in this because it poses a huge problem for many countries, that because we still have not eliminated problems of undernutrition, these kinds of mm-hmm. deficiencies that we're talk about in the rest of the world, and I'm talking about Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, and so on. The speed of change, there are dramatic increases in overweight and obesity, and it's no longer the case that it's a problem of the elites. And I'll give the example of Mexico, which in the 90s, obesity almost tripled, and the distribution of weight in the Mexican population is not that different from that of the U.S. And what's interesting is that when you look at where did this epidemic occurred, it occurred in all regions of Mexico. If you know Mexico, you'll know that the South is very indigenous, it's very poor, has a lot of child malnutrition. Well, the South experienced as much an increase in obesity as the North and Central Mexico. And the other thing that we have examined is the relationship between obesity in Mexico and socioeconomic status, and find that there is no relationship. It's just as likely to be found among the poor as among the wealthier. And in Latin America, in countries like Chile, we have begun to see now that obesity has become a marker of poverty. Just like in the U.S., it's more common in minorities and less educated, for example, adults. And that's where the developing world is headed. And so we have a dual agenda. We have problems of undernutrition and overnutrition in places like Mexico. And so it's tough to deal with those.
I'm sure that a lot of people would find that surprising, that they would understand that here in a country like the United States, it's no mystery what's going on. Partly it seems to be that overall caloric intake exceeds people's energy needs, so that's part of it. We're told that we're not as active as we should be, but also the quality of the diet has something to do with it too. So that if people are consuming foods that have, for example, that have a lot of fat, the nutritional quality of the diet that has something to do with it too. And I guess I wouldn't think that would be an issue in the developing world, but I guess that must be.
It is. What happened was, we in the 60s and 70s, we were very concerned with with low energy intakes, and there were policies, for example, to produce vegetable oils cheaply so that we could fill this calorie gap. And now, for example, vegetable oils are accessible to people in developing countries. And energy intakes have increased. The energy density has increased. But this has been a good thing because one of the great achievements of the 20th century, for example, was to control famines in places like India and China. Unfortunately, we still have them because of political upheavals and whatnot, poor governance in Africa. But so that's been a good thing. But what people have called the nutrition transition, epidemiological transition, with urbanization, with economic development, we have changed. We have made sort of gone from energy deficits to energy surpluses. And also in these kinds of societies, urbanized, poor, physical activity is impacted greatly. Mm. For example, for the poor in developing countries, there is really not much of an opportunity for discretionary exercise activity. In the slums, they're crowded. There are no playing fields for children. Television has become a cheap form of entertainment. And so this increase in sedentarism or sitting, passive recreation. So there are many of the very same changes that have occurred in developed countries. We're seeing them in developing countries as well.
We have a caller here to talk with and other folks who are listening. We have about 20 minutes left. Of the folks who are listening, if you have questions, you certainly are welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Champaign County and line one.
Hi. This probably isn't germane to your research and your work in the third world, but I think it's part of the discussion, and I don't want to get too complicated with it, but you mentioned the World Bank is supporting these kind of dietary solutions, et cetera, but the World Bank and IMF have always been for cash cropping and this argument about production comparative advantage, and this overlaid on a real colonialism of the past that grabbed up the best land and forced people off of it. I'm just saying that there's a whole backdrop here you know, it's easy to be philanthropic or something and feeling beneficent and feeling that we're not doing enough. But it seems that if we just stop doing what we're doing in some ways as an industrialized world, it's taking more capital out of the third world than putting in development aid, is that things would solutions could be indigenously done, and we wouldn't have all of this. People are obese because they don't have a plot of land to work on anymore to grow their own food on, which might have been healthier. We have examples from that go back to Central American history where the dietary, and this is where it gets kind of digresses a little bit, but it's an interesting bit from the history of the colonialization of Central America, that amaranth or quinona, I think, are two of the names for it, was very high protein grain, but it became banned by the Spaniards when they were coming in because it was a religious symbol of some sort or another. And actually, some people say that cultural anthropologists, I guess, would be the category of people that would say it, that this disruption of their dietary scheme that was indigenous, and not, this isn't to glorify, you know, golden age, the indigenous people, but there's certainly a lot of things that have been disrupted that, you know, I'm thinking of now of food first and the whole revelation of, you know, the most peasant food diets include a combination of rice and beans, which is a synergistic use of the proteins in the two, and complementary proteins. So there's a lot of, and that, I'm digressing again, but that's sort of the wisdom of peasant cultures that we have been ignoring and have been arrogant about, it seems to me. Now, there's about four or five threads in there, and I have to attend to something here.
All right,
so
well,
why don't I just hang up and see if you can sort some of that out for us all. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, you raise some interesting points. The World Bank, I think we would all agree, has made mistakes in the past. The kind of support, for example, that we saw, the kinds of programs that they had, you know, some 20, 30 years ago, is to build, heavily focused on building infrastructure with the theory that development would trickle down. And I think that's changed. And I'm talking about the kinds of programs that they have where, in fact, they have bought the argument that a good start in life is important and are providing financing for the kinds of programs I was describing, nutrition and health programs in places like India, like Bangladesh, and in places like Honduras, my own country, with the belief that it is, in fact, after all, it is a bank, but that it's a long-term development strategy to improve the quality of life in early childhood. I support those programs. Another comment I wanted to make is that I think we do tend to romanticize the past. And I'm from Central America, and I can tell you that, you know, childhood mortality rates were extremely high. Diets were very, very poor. A lot of infections and so on. You know, when you look at the statistics, infant mortality rates have come down. They still need to come down some more. And about globalization, I think it's a reality. And I think what we need to do is not stop it because it's impossible, rather guide it. I think we need to make the best, you know. And a final comment, that there is a lot we need to learn from traditional diets and certainly in every country in terms of, I'm now talking about nutrition education and trying to improve diets. We have to look carefully at what are the resources available in terms of native plants and foods, and where possible, incorporate them into our programs.
Mm. All right, let's talk with someone in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I agree we shouldn't romanticize the past, but we need to define the past. If you've got infant mortality data, you're talking about the colonial past and not the pre-colonial past. And one thing that we know about before most people entered into cash cropping that they had a wide range of foods, including wild and cultivated, and that alone ensured a much better nutritional health than we've seen once people start to rely on commercial products or buying some of their food to replace what they're not growing. But that wasn't what I called about. I was calling about your statistics for sub-Saharan Africa, and you only touched on it briefly when you mentioned political upheaval, but is your group looking at the effect of war and low-intensity conflict? Because certainly we know by now that war always disrupts food systems and has a very tragic effect on women and children in general, just because they unfortunately are more and more the victims of most warfare. So given that there seems to be no end to the conflicts in South Africa, what approach are you going to, can you take? Because as long as these countries, their governments are involved in purchasing weaponry, a great deal of the money goes to that. And even if they are putting money into their health system, just the problems caused by violent conflict, the fact that people end up herding together in migrant camps, I mean, what approach is your group looking at to deal with the realities of what the future of, the, let's say, the immediate future of sub-Saharan Africa looks like right now?
Well, you know, I'm at a school of public health, and we deal with some of the problems. One problem that you didn't mention is AIDS, which is having an enormous impact in sub-Saharan Africa because it kills young men and women in their productive years, and it disrupts everything that you were talking about.
But that's also spread by warfare.
Yes, but yeah. it's even if peace were to be achieved, we would have the problem of AIDS. And one unit at Emory that's working on this is the Carter Center. Issues of peace, issues of governance, of trying to introduce democratization, and so that group is very active trying to promote good governance. This is a very, very difficult problem, and you're right. I mean, the reason why all the nutrition and health indicators in sub-Saharan Africa are worsening is due to this, you know, complex mixture of problems, and we need to deal, we need to address those. Because if otherwise, anything we do in health and nutrition, and if that's all we do, we're not going to have a sustainable impact.
Yes, I think that really is the challenge to public health right now, is to try to work within the reality of conflict that seems just to be exploding, you know, across the globe. Because as we saw in Iraq, quite often the humanitarian workers simply have to leave. And so the old model of bringing in the knowledge from outside may not be able to work anymore, and we might need to start thinking and how do you train people in areas of conflict, the local people, to the realities and help them to even the smallest amount of intervention that might be helpful.
I agree with you.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Perhaps I should just very quickly again introduce our guest for anyone who has tuned in last 20 minutes or so. We're talking with Rinaldo Martorell. He's professor of international nutrition in the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta, and is visiting here to talk a little bit about the state of nutrition in the developing world. I'll be giving a talk this afternoon on the U of I campus. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. On again to another caller. This is Urbana in line one. Hello.
Yeah, I just have a specific question. I was curious. You said that globalization is a thing you can't stop, and you sound somewhat resigned to its effects, but wouldn't you be able to point to particular nutritional problems because of what countries like the U.S. Is pushing on the third world, like in particular. I understand a lot of people think a lot of our problem here in the United States with early onset diabetes is the pushing of corn syrup into all of our foods, and that's due to our companies like Archer Daniels Midland having corn syrup in surplus, and they want to market it, and they're pushing it out into the third world as well. Can't you specifically look at things like corn syrup being pushed on the third world as a particular problem of world trade?
I didn't mean to imply that one needs to be passive about globalization. The point I was making is that it is a phenomenon that it's taking place and it will come. And what I meant to say, perhaps it aligns with what you're saying, is that we need to guide it. And certainly, we were just talking about this epidemic of obesity. We need to be very, very proactive and think in new ways. I'll bring the example of Bogota, Colombia, which is, we all know about the problems that Colombia has been having. But Bogota is an example of a community where there's been a lot of effort to promote physical activity by innovative urban development, by promoting, physical activity, events, green areas. And that's the kind of thing we need to do. We need to create, healthier environments. We need to promote, physical activity and also to promote good diets. We need to, in developing countries, just like in this country, a lot of food is consumed outside of the home and a lot of this is native foods that are quickly prepared that are also energy dense, and there is also, as you implied, a whole host of products coming in from the international markets, and that's a big task, the promotion of healthier diets.
I don't suppose that there's any kind of institution, international institution, that would be capable of putting together an argument that there are negative health effects to and therefore there's a justification of putting a tariff, say, on imports that are heavily corns, heavily carbohydrates, heavy in carbohydrates, or mostly corn syrup. That kind of thinking. Is there any kind of institution that could possibly do that? Because I know these countries would be hard pressed to have to do their own research and launch their own arguments through the WTO and all that.
Well, in terms of the promotion of healthier diets, the World Health Organization is the lead institution. In terms of what you're describing, is there an international body that can set tariffs? No.
I meant that would help a country put an argument before the WTO that here's some actual evidence, scientific evidence that the importation of this food commodity actually has negative health effects, and therefore we're going to limit the importation or somehow hinder it.
There are lots of research institutions that contribute research that's relevant to this. So there is some one another strategy that may be actually good would be to promote, for example, I think we need to, governments need to look at the production of fruits and vegetables. They're expensive, and that's one reason they're not as consumed as we would like. And I think investing in those kinds of products would be a good thing. Mm.
I think we're at the point where we're going to have to stop, at least for this first hour of the show, because we're coming to the end of the time. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, I do want to mention that our guest, Reynaldo Monterrell, will be giving a talk on the U of I campus this afternoon. This is part of the ACES Global Connect seminar series, and I think that anyone's interested in stopping by should feel welcome. He'll be talking on this subject about the state of nutrition in the developing world this afternoon at 2 o'clock at the ACES Library, and that's at 1101 South Goodwin on the U of I campus. Our guest, Reynaldo Monterrell, he's professor of international nutrition in the Department of International Health at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods. With foods from around the world, currently they're featuring foods from Italy, including Italian cheeses like Parmesan Reggiano, oils, vinegar, Italian chocolates, cookies, and coffee with taste samplings available. World Harvest Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. The broadcast is also made possible with support from local Baha'i communities who are sponsoring the nationally recognized children's entertainer Red Grammar in concert at Lincoln Square this Saturday, May 1st at 11 a.m. The concert is in conjunction with a grand opening celebration of the newly remodeled Baha'i Center in Urbana. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with British historian Hugh Strawn from Oxford University. He is the author of a recently published one-volume history of World War I that was created to accompany a public television series that was produced in Britain, that is on their public television, a history of World War I. He's now visiting some here in the United States to talk a little bit about the book, and will be talking with us by telephone in the next part of Focus 580 about World War I. So I hope that you will stay with us for that. Coming up very shortly, we'll have news in a minute past the hour, and before that, an update on the commodity markets.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
And with this update on the markets coming up on 10:59, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. The May wheat contract up 6 cents now at 378.5. July also up 6 cents.